This is a Truth for Today recording. Oscar M. Baker is speaking. And the date is Sunday, June the 29th, 1986. And our subject is an exposition or reading of the Book of Acts. And we have gotten down so far to chapter 23, verse 19. We finished with that. And the instance here will not give you a complete resume, but synopsis, we might say, that Paul has been caught in the temple of Jerusalem at his return from the west and taken into the castle and being examined by the Roman officials, and right at the very last, we find that Paul's sister, little boy, comes and has a message for Paul, and Paul sends him on to the captain. And he says to him, "What is it thou hast to tell me?" And the little boy says, and he said, "The Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldst bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. But do not thou this, but do not thou yield unto them, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath, that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, looking for a promise from thee." Well, that's what happens so often, a conspiracy or something like that. It'll leak out. It told some way. At any rate, the chief captain is wise to what's going on now. It'll be up to him. "For the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, see thou tell no man what thou showed, that thou hast showed these things to me. So just be quiet now. We'll see what turns out. And he called unto him two centurions," that'd be two men with 200 men, "saying, make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 70, that'd be 70 horsemen, and spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night. I'll leave at nightfall." Boy, he's making up an army here to take care of this man Paul. Did you realize that? How many people are involved in this? To take him up to Caesarea, to where the castle is, of court, "and provide them beasts that they may set Paul on, and bring him safe unto Felix, the governor." You know, I wonder if these 40 men or more, if they ever did eat again, or just go to the old star for this. But we don't know, do we? "And he wrote," that is, the chief captain here, "wrote a letter after this manner. And his name is Claudius Lysias," we see now. "Claudius Lysias, unto the most excellent governor, Felix, sendeth greeting. This man was taken of the Jews, and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army," oh boy, look at the exaggeration, "and rescued him," having understood that he was a Roman. Well, he didn't understand the first he was a Roman, that came out later. Well, this fellow tells the truth like most politicians do, and so on. "And when I would have known the cause wherewith they accused him, I brought him forth into their council, whom I perceive to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. And when it was told me how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sent straightway to thee, and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell." Well, Claudius Lysias is mighty glad to get this thing out of his hands, for one thing. He's got something on his hands he can't quite handle. He's Jews.
So he's going to turn it over to the governor. Wash his hands of the affair. Let the governor take it.
Well, that's another way of looking around it, Chief. At any rate, this is what is happening. Verse 31. Then the soldiers, as it was commanded him, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatria. On the morrow they left a horseman to go with him and returned to the castle. Who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. They got in there safely. I expect it was all over before these 40 men knew what was even happening, what had happened.
And when the governor had read the letter, he asked what province he was. When he understood he was of Cilicia, "I will hear thee," said he, "when thy accusers are come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Now, was Paul a prisoner there or not? Now, he's a Roman citizen, remember? Why, he was kept there as a guest in his judgment hall. He had freedom there. Of course, he had a guard to see that nobody got to him. But Paul is a Roman citizen and being treated as such. Well, chapter 24. And after 5 days, Ananias, a high priest, descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. He's got a big lawyer, along with the high priest and the elders. They're going to have a real time here. They're going to really have something to say about Paul. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always, in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness." But he's accusing Felix, and he's starting out and talking like this. Now, what is he getting at? Well, notwithstanding, that's a nice word, you can stumble over that one and get your breath. "That I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee, that thou wouldst hear us of thy clemency a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition," boy, it sounds like a lawyer, "among all the Jews, throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes." They are calling the people who follow the Lord Jesus Christ Nazarenes, "who also are going about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law." They were going to go about it, they would have judged him according to their law. "But the chief captain Lysias came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands." Some more exaggeration on the other side. "Commanding his accusers to come unto thee by examining, of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so." Well, they got a great crowd of witnesses against him, haven't they? "Then Paul, after that the governor had directed him to speak, answered, 'Forasmuch as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went to Jerusalem for to worship. And they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me.'" Paul says, "I haven't been doing any of these things they said he'd been doing," and he hadn't. "But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and have hope for God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And here is a little stumbling block. A resurrection, both of the just and the unjust. Remember, the Jews are heirs of salvation. The seed of Abraham. And yet all through the Old Testament we find that there are believers among those Jews who are just and there are some who are unjust. And we have it yet today. In our churches and our denominations and all the things that we have believers, some just, some unjust. The old nature being in them, in all of us. Who can say that he's perfectly just? I can't. Can you? And herein do I exercise myself, to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. In other words, Paul says, I'm trying very hard not to offend God or man. Well, after many years, I came to bring alms to my nation and offerings. And of course, that's what they had. They had brought things from Macedonia and other places. Whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult, who ought to have been here before thee, I object as they had all against me. They're the ones that ought to be making the accusation, but they aren't there. Or else let these same here say, if they have found any evil in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. And of course there was a division between the Pharisees and the Sadducees on the question of resurrection. And when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them and said, when Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. He isn't seeing anything wrong, but he says, I'll find out more when the chief captain comes down from the castle. And he commanded his centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, that he should forbid none of his acquaintances to minister or come unto him. As I said a little while ago, he's treated more of a visitor than he is a prisoner. He has practiced the run of the place. And after certain days, when Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. So here is Felix coming on the scene too. And his wife, Drusilla, who is a Jewess. Well, now, there's some gossip about that and so on. I don't think it's necessary to bring that up right now. And as he, that is, Paul, reasoned righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, go thy way for this time. When I have a more convenient season, I will call for thee. Now, Paul reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come. Now, if we were to go back into Matthew and find about this judgment to come, we find that the nations will be judged according to how they have treated the Jews in their time of trouble and tribulation. And no doubt Paul is bringing this up. And Felix trembled. His wife was a Jewess. I wonder how he treated his wife. That made him tremble or something? Also, how has he, as a governor, how has he been treating the Jews under his jurisdiction? Well, anyhow, he trembled. He says, get out for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee. And notice this. He hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might lose him. Wherefore, he sent for him the oftener and communed with him. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. They should have set him free. But he's going to try to play politics with the Jews and act as if he was siding with them. So he left Paul bound. Not bound literally, but kept in restriction. Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul and besought him, and desired favor against him, that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. There's still, I don't know whether this 40 days is up yet or not. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly thither. Let them therefore, said he, which among you are able, go down with me, and accuse this man, if there be any wickedness in him. Looks as if the Jews were kind of foiled on every hand. And when he had tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews, which came down from Jerusalem, stood about, round about, and laid many grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. Now let them prove it. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judge of these things before me? Well, I'd be playing right into the hands of the Jews, and Paul might be murdered. Then said Paul, and here is a momentous statement, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender, or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things, whereof these accuse me, no man may me deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar. And that was right, for the Roman citizen, and if he didn't like the judgment he got out in one of the provinces, he could appeal to Caesar, and be taken to Rome and have his case taken care of there. So Paul was taking advantage of this Roman law, and he's going to stand before Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the consul, answered, Hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Under Caesar shalt thou go. Okay. And after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came into Caesarea to salute Festus. Well, there isn't too good a story about their relationship either, but we won't stop for the gossip. And when there had been many days, Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king, saying, There's a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him. To whom I answered, It is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. That is Roman law. He had every chance. There wasn't any fooling around and letting a man be executed without a chance to defend himself. Therefore, when they were come hither without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom, when the accusers stood up, they brought non-accusation of such things as I suppose, but had certain questions against him of their own superstition or religion, and of one Jesus, which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. And when Paul had appealed to be reserved under the hearing of Augustus, Caesar, I commanded him to be kept till I might send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said unto Festus, I would also hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, thou shalt hear him. Well, he says, I'm curious. I'd like to hear what the fellow has to say. Well, I'm not making too much comment on this because it's quite plain, and if you're listening carefully, you'll get the story. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp, and was entered into the palace of hearing, with the chief captain and principal men of the city, at Festus' commandment Paul was brought forth. And Festus said, King Agrippa, all men which are present with us, you see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord. Wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and especially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. Here he's sending to Augustus Caesar for judgment, and he hasn't got a thing to write about it. No accusation. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crime laid against him. He was right about that. Send a prisoner, no charge, well, that wouldn't be sensible. All right. Chapter 26. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, Thou art permitted to speak for thyself. Then Paul stretched forth his hand and answered for himself, I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before thee, touching all the things whereof I am accused of the Jews, especially because I know thee to be expert in all the customs and questions which are among the Jews. Wherefore, I beseech thee to hear me patiently. My manner of life, from my youth, which was at the first among mine own nation at Jerusalem, know all the Jews, which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify, that after the most greatest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers. The hope, the promise. Judge for that, the promise of the Messiah. Under which promise, our 12 tribes instantly, that is all the time serving God day and night, hope to come. They're still hoping for him to come. They don't know he has come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. Why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? Incredible, I guess, unbelievable. Knowing that the religion of the Jews and the Pharisees and so on, why, Agrippa should know. Paul says that very much. I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, which thing I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. And I punished them oft in every synagogue, and compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even in the strange cities, even Damascus. Whereupon, as I went to Damascus with authority and commission from the chief priests, at midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven above the brightness of the sun, shining around about me, and them which journeyed with me. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me, and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks, or is it hard for thee to kick against the pricks? And I said, Who art thou, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. I want you to notice here that Paul is not making very much variation in his story on just things that happened several years before. He remembers it very vividly, and he tells it again as he told it at the first. And I said, Who art thou, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. But rise and stand upon thy feet. For I have appeared unto thee for this purpose, to make thee a minister and a witness both of these things which thou hast seen, of the things which I will appear unto thee, delivering thee from the people and from the Gentiles, unto whom now I send thee, to open their eyes, and to turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins, and inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith that is in thee. Whereupon, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision, but showed first unto them of Damascus, and at Jerusalem, and throughout all the coasts of Judea, and then to the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God, do works for repentance. For these causes the Jews caught me in the temple, and went about to kill me. Having therefore obtained help of God, I continue unto this day, witnessing both to small and great, saying none other things than those which the prophets of Moses did say should come. Notice this, saying none other things than what Moses and the prophet, what the prophets of Moses did say should come. He's kept strictly to the scriptures. But that Christ should suffer, that he should be the first that should rise from the dead, and show light unto the people and to the Gentiles. So that was a pretty good witness there, wasn't it? Paul really packed it into a few words, made it plain. And as he thus spake for himself, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, thou art beside thyself. Much learning doth make thee mad. Paul, you're certainly crazy. But he said, I'm not mad, most noble Festus, but speak forth the words of truth and soberness. For the king knoweth of these things, before whom also I speak freely. For I am persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him, for this thing was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, believest thou the prophets? I know that thou believest. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Now, there's been a great deal of debate about that statement. Some say, well, Paul, are you trying to make me a Christian? Or something to that effect? Or is he saying, making fun of him, says, well, you're almost persuading me to be a Christian. Well, how are you going to take it? Well, I believe Agrippa was touched with this testimony. And if it weren't for circumstances, he could have been a Christian. But being in the position he was in and so on, that had been fatal to all of his ambitions, to his political life. And Paul said, I would to God that not only thou, but also all that hear me this day, are both almost and altogether such as I am, except these bonds. This says, I wish that they were all like me and what know what I know and so on, except I wouldn't want them to be in bonds. And when he had thus spoken, the king rose up, and the governor, and Bernice, and they that sat with him. And when they were gone aside, they talked between themselves, saying, This man doeth nothing worthy of death or of bonds. Then said Agrippa unto Festus, This man might have been set at liberty if he had not appealed unto Caesar. Might have been. That ends chapter 26. The drama is getting rather tense, isn't it? And we're wondering where this is going to go to next. Oh, a lot of us have read it before. We know. But it's somehow, it's the old story that we like to hear over and over. The faithfulness of Paul. The message that he had. How much he was like his master, the Lord Jesus Christ. Showing forth that kind of a spirit. We can say that we too can find no fault in him. Well, chapter 27. Luke is still speaking. And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, that's where Rome is, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. And entering into a ship at Adramyttium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia. One Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. I think we have heard of him before. And the next day we touched at Sidon. It's near Tyre. And Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go to his friends to refresh himself. We're always giving Paul liberty and helping him. And when he had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. We sailed under Cyprus. Well, now, look at your map. Maybe that might help. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myrna, a city of Cilicia. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us thereon. So they're changing ships. And when we had sailed slowly many days, and scarce were come over against Cnidus, C-N-I-D-U-S, Cnidus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under Crete, over against Salmone. And hardly passing it, came into a place which is called a Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lasea. Making progress rather slowly, not much wind and so on, I suppose. Now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them and said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and the ship, but also of our lives. So Paul is telling it might be a good idea to stop at Fair Havens and spend the winter, because getting that time, and that's a bad time on the Mediterranean. It is a tempestuous little sea. Can't be trusted anymore in our Gulf of Mexico, can. Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master, and the owner of the ship more than those things which are spoken by Paul. And because the haven is not commodious to winter in, the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phoenicia, or Phoenis we would call it, and there to winter, which is in the haven of Crete, and lies toward the southwest and northwest. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sailed close to Crete, not obeying what Paul had advised at all. But not long after, there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Euroclydon. When the ship was caught and could not bear up into the wind, we let her drive. In other words, it's best, if at all possible, to keep the front, the bow of the ship, right into the wind. But they couldn't do it. They couldn't steer it. They couldn't hold it. And so they had to let it go the other way, with the waves coming over the stern, and that is a dangerous position, even in a rowboat. I know. I've been through it. So I understand some of these things. And so they just let it drive before the wind. And that is. And running under a certain island, which is called Claudia, we had much work to come by the boat. That is. Which, when they had taken up, they used helps, undergirding the ship. And fearing lest they should fall into the quicksand, straight sail, and so were driven. Undergirding means that they wrapped ropes around the ship and pull them tight so that it wouldn't spring and the waves and so on and get a leak or something. And so they pulled it tight. They had a big cargo and the ship was loaded, not only with some wheat, but also with men. And so they were afraid to get into the quicksand, and so they let the wind dry them again. Well, that's pretty poor sailmanship, but then I guess maybe that's about all they could do. And we, being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. That is, they threw out some of the cargo, make it a little lighter. It's just too heavy. And I suspect it was under the waves about half of the time, then it bobbed up. And the third day, we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. Well, now that is something I should not get rid of either, all the pulleys and the ropes and the stuff that they use for unloading, loading, and for handling the ship. They threw all of that out. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. Couldn't make it. But after long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me, and not have loosed from Crete, to have gained this harm and loss. Now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. It'll be lost. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me. Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island." But when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adria, about midnight the shipmen deemed that they, or thought that they, came near to some country, and sounded, that is, checked the depth of the water. Well, that, at that time, was done by letting down a line with a weight on it, and measuring, and found it 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. So the water is getting shallower. Then, fearing that we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast four anchors out of the stern. Of course, that is where it was being pushed from, so about the only thing they could do. And wished for the day. Pretty bad sight. And as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea, under color as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, "Except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved." But to stay with the ship. Then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat, let her fall off. So they had no lifeboat left now. And while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take meat, that is, eat something, saying, "This day is the 14th day that ye have tarried, and continued fasting, having taken nothing. Wherefore I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health. For there will not be an hair fall from the head of any of you." And when he had thus spoken, he took bread, and gave thanks to God in presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then were they all a good cheer, and they also took some meat. And we were in all in the ship 216 souls. Let's see now, let's add that up. 216 would be 260, and 16 would be 276 people on the boat. That must have been a pretty good sized boat at that, having had a cargo and then all these people on it. Well, not much of a boat in the waves of the Mediterranean Sea, I can tell you that. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea, So they've gotten rid of their load now. Well, that'll make the ship carry a little higher and not wouldn't be quite so apt to hit rocks and rip the bottom out of it. And when it was day, they knew not the land, but they discovered a certain creek to the shore, into the which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust the ship. A creek. Now, I can tell you that if you want a good history of this, I haven't mentioned this before, I didn't mention once that you could study the book of Acts, the From Pentecost to Prison by Mr. Welch. But there's a 2-volume set on the life and epistles of St. Paul by Coney Barenhausen. And in it they give a great deal of the details and where these things happen and so on. It's very good to read about Paul's journey here. And we find here this word creek. Creek. But you know, in every other place, that word is translated bosom. Now, what would that have to do with this land formation here? Well, it just means that on each side was a hill and a stream of water, as they had appeared to them to be. Of course, we find now it was a strait. And on the one side was an island. On the right side and on the left was the main island. And so they called it a creek because of the formation of the land, the hills. It looked like a bosom. And when they had taken up the acres, they committed themselves unto the sea and loosed the rudder bands and hoisted up the mainsail to the wind and made toward the shore. You want to go as far as it can before they get grounded and have to swim for it. And falling into a place where two seas met. And you find that when the breakers come, where they come to meet, and that's kind of a bad place. They ran the ship aground, and the fore part stuck fast and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. That could happen a little bit. Just break it to pieces. And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest if any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that they should swim, that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of ship, and so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. Now, it's rather interesting in your geography to follow that course, and so on. Now, there are differences of opinion as to the course that the ship took. And I have seen one map in which a man imagined that it had been driven by the winds almost down to the coast of Africa, and around in a circle and back. And that is to this island of Melita, which we're talking about here. And others have them zigzagging back and forth in a fairly straight line. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't know which to believe or anything like that. I just imagine that in that storm that the wind kept rather consistently in the same direction. Although I know that if it were the hurricane's type, that it would be going in a circular motion and it wouldn't be going, the wind wouldn't be the same direction all the time. And I think that's possibly what some thought, and had the wind going in a circular motion, taking them down toward Africa and around in a circle and up to Melita. Now, they may have had a reason for that. I'm not too acquainted with all the weather and so on, but I do know something about the forces of the cyclonic winds and the directions they take and so on. And so, this brings us up to chapter 28, our last chapter. Dear Father, I do thank thee for these words, for thy record, Paul, and his faithfulness, and also that later on he becomes the great apostle of us Gentiles. Thankful the message that he had then, and the message he has for us now. We're thankful for Thy Spirit is teaching, helping us to understand these things, that we might know the reason why Paul made these journeys and the outcome. And we're thankful that Thy Spirit has helped us to understand the mystery. Guide us and direct us in these studies that we may gain knowledge of Thy truth and Thy ways, and that we might learn more about Thy great Apostle Paul, his faithfulness, that we might believe the message that he has for us today through Christ's word.